They change cultures. They're heat seekers. They run at adversity and embrace change. These are the Room Tilters.
Somebody who can change the temperature in a room when they walk in. I mean, that's metaphorical for somebody who can influence those around them and make it such an impact quickly, emphatically, and long-lasting, whether it be an organization, a team, a relationship, whatever it might be.
This is the Room Tilters podcast, presented by Limitless Minds. Co-hosts DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, founders of peak performance and leadership consulting company, Limitless Minds, explore how the best and brightest change the temperature in a room. From sports, the military, entertainment and media, clinical psychologists to CEOs, this podcast will navigate what it takes to think big and go far. And now, DJ and Harry.
All right, we're back on the Room Tilters podcast today. We have an awesome guest, Dr. Hillary McBride. She's a registered clinical counselor in Vancouver. She holds a PhD in counseling psychology from UBC, and she was recently awarded the International Young Investor Award for her research contributions so early in her career. So curious to see like what you think were the biggest takeaways and why people should stay and listen to this particular episode, because it's a little different. It's a little of departure from some of the guests we've had in the past. And, you know, we talked a little bit about therapy and the value in that. Talk about empathy. You know, we talked about, you know, embodiment, disembodiment, and all these different things.
I mean, listen, anxiety is high. You know, people are in some cases fearful, and you're just being bombarded with a lot of negativity, whether it's through social media, the news. Having tools and being able to navigate through that is really important. Hillary gives us some really good tools to do that. And she talks about how empathy is so important in dealing with people, your families, and your relationships. She talks about language and she uses this phrase, a body that is good. She's going to get into some of that and talk about how the way we look at ourselves and we treat ourselves is powerful in terms of, you know, our success and how we navigate through the world. There were so many great nuggets. This is one of those guests that we're going to have on again. I think there's a stigma with counseling in general. Really awesome conversation with her. And I'm excited for the listeners to get a sneak peek with Hillary.
All right. So Hillary McBride, let's go.
Welcome to the Room Tilters podcast. Our guest today, Hillary McBride out of Vancouver, Canada. She's a clinical counselor, a speaker, a writer, and also host of a podcast called Other People's Problems. Hillary, we are so excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. What an honor to be with you too.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So listen, I've got a chance to listen to your podcast and sample a couple episodes of really intriguing. Harry and I were talking about this morning. The fact that like you actually bring your own patients onto the podcast, right? Some of your own clients and really talk through some sensitive issues and work through them. Really excited to hear about like, how did you get started, you know, doing in clinical counseling? And then how did you parlay that into a podcast?
Right. Yeah, it is. It's a bit disjointed. It wasn't part of the master plan once upon a time, but I got really interested in psychology from an early age because both my parents are therapists. And so the joke is, we were doing dream analysis at the dinner table. Like this was just a thing that happened where my parents would come home. And of course, like in ways that protect confidentiality. But when I asked my dad, like, what are you doing at work today? And he's like, well, like I'm working with a survivor of childhood sexual abuse who is, you know, has a personality disorder. And this is kind of how I feel after doing that all day with somebody. And just the quality of the conversation and gave me this understanding about the depth that people can go to in terms of their pain, but also what healing can look like. And just this kind of whole trajectory of being human across the lifespan, the things that we encounter, but also how resilient we are, how we're able to overcome and what in us allows us to do that. So that was part of the kitchen table vernacular, so to speak. And I think in a way, like the word is sometimes we have an adverse reaction to it, but like kind of groomed in a way, like there, I was given this knowledge from a really early age. And I felt I have a part in me that like really wants to own my identity and really wants to be me instead of just kind of taking on this, you know, what you might say, like the family business. So pushed really hard against that and was like, I'm not going to be a therapist. I'm not going to be a psychologist. And went to school for violin. I studied performance violin from my undergrad and then just really for like a bunch of reasons, particularly my own mental health, I was really struggling with an eating disorder and felt like I needed to get space from this life that I had built that was so perfectionistic. It was so driven. I mean, for those of you who play classical music, I think it's actually probably quite similar to sports in terms of the rigor of like, it has do it again, do it again, do it perfectly again, again, again. And like the thing that's in my mind at the end of the night is, why didn't I get that note? Why couldn't I get that arpeggio? Mm-hmm. What am I going to engineer specifically so that I can get it perfect again and again and again? And I just needed, I needed space from that. So left, moved into this, it's kind of a crazy story, maybe for another time, moved into this birth house in the Northern Philippines with nobody who spoke English, and in this kind of tribal area where there was no access to medical care, and was helping to deliver some babies, and really wanted this experience of what does it mean to be a body in a way that's good. So I had been really struggling with like, how do I be a body? Like, all I want to do is make my body disappear. How do I be a body that's good? And there was something about the birth experience that it was like this doorway into trusting that there, my body is wise. And so came back from the Philippines, and kind of in this roundabout way, ended up studying psychology, which to me feels like, sometimes you use this, this metaphor that psychology is kind of like being a midwife of the mind. It's kind of like being this, this skilled support person to help transform pain into something that gets born, into life that comes through on the other side. So then went back to, you know, did more training and did my master's and my PhD. And yeah, so I think like somewhere along the way, I think it was partway through my doctoral program, which is in Canada, we do a master's that's separate and then PhD that's separate. In the States, usually they're kind of one combined thing, but it was part of my, during my PhD, there was an editor, a producer from CBC, which is Canada's kind of like NPR, so to speak, who approached me and a bunch of people and said, I've just been to therapy. And like, why isn't anyone talking about how this is like, therapy is like this. It's not like what we see on TV. So it was actually her idea. And she pitched this idea of having recording of sessions. So like, I'm not doing anything different. I'm not performing. I'm not like, I'm sitting in my office with my patients like I normally do. We just have mics on. And it was her idea to say like, we need to really dissolve the stigma around mental health by giving people access to what care actually looks like, and help us tell a different story about who accesses care. Cause I think for a lot of people, therapy is for people who are like, I use air quotes, like crazy people, or people who are like, oh, you have to be on the edge. You have to break down and then you get care. And to show that normal people come into therapy because they're like, I want to love myself more, or wow, I have this reaction to my kids and I don't know why I'm having that reaction, or I don't know how to take in love from other people. Like these like very normal things that are actually quite part of being human in our culture, that those can be things that are worked on. And there's something about doing the podcast in this way that, because it's anonymous, people feel like they are willing to let people into their therapeutic process. And they actually, what's really fascinating, when I ask the people in my, on the podcast, my patients, like, how has this impacted you? There's a sense of I get to give back to change culture just by doing my work, just by showing up and doing my healing. I get to change the fabric of our society in such a way that maybe there are other people who are going to get care that wouldn't otherwise.
Right.
So it's become generative for them as well to be a part of this movement of making therapy accessible.
Well, I can tell you what, it's powerful. And what I realized with you, and I've learned from listening to you, is that you listen very, very well. Like, you know, you give your patients and the clients you work with an opportunity to speak and feel heard, and you ask great questions. And, you know, I think there's a lot of folks out there. There's a ton of places where we can get feedback and advice, and I can Google anything, right? And get the answer, you know? And so but you connect very well with the folks that you're talking to and your patients, and you sense that when you listen to your podcast. So great job with that.
Thank you so outstanding. Much. It means so much to me. And this is like, I mean, you're hitting on it already, but we don't develop the wounds that we carry around because someone gave us bad information when we were two or three. It's not like we really even understood that someone was giving us a message or an idea. We didn't Google bad information when we were five and we right. shot all our emotions down so that we didn't get hit or whatever the story is. Like, it's, the information was not the problem. It was the relational experiences of not having space for what's happening for us, for not being heard and witnessed in our pain. And we now understand that one of the most significant transforming experiences in terms of what we're doing with the things that hurt us inside is not getting new information. It's having what we call a corrective experience, which is what we needed back then, but getting it now in such a way that our pain can go, oh, I'm heard. And so I don't have to keep holding on so tight just to get someone's care, someone's attention. As much as information is helpful, like, therapy will never be in its most effective state when we are just giving information. It will be because someone cares for us and we get the experience of that and we take it in.
Wow.
Hey, you said something that was really simple, and it's almost so simple that I'm wondering if I'm if I misinterpret it, right? Okay. Or maybe, like, you were talking about the you know, your time at the birth house and helping give birth. And you mentioned something about a desire to have a body that's good. What is that? What do you mean by that? Like, what does that really mean? Because it might be a different phrase or a different way of kind of wrapping that up than most people might consider.
Harry, you just walked right into my favorite thing to talk about in the entire world. Okay, perfect. So I don't know whether to say I'm sorry or you're welcome. Perfect. We have this, okay, well, if I step back just a little bit and we look at the fabric of our sociocultural landscape, most of us exist in a kind of disembodied state where the body is something to conquer. I mean, we can even look at perhaps a world that maybe the two of you are a little bit more familiar with and look at athletics and say, this is how you get prowess. This is how you achieve. You conquer your physicality. You make your mind sharp and strong, and you subdue the body. Push down the impulses, push down the tired, push down the fatigue. And that can be a way to accrue power and agency. But what most of us don't realize is that that disembodiment that we hold so dearly in our culture as a way to be powerful is actually reinforcing oppressive narratives. So when we ask about what are the isms in the world, what are the stories that are oppressive that pull people apart from each other and give people less access to freedom and safety, almost every single one of our isms is about the body. What kind of body is good? What kind of body is respected? What kind of body is powerful? What kind of body gets access to social space? What kind of body gets to make decisions about other people's bodies? Patriarchy, right? All the way to racism, homophobia, like kind of our ableism in our society and the way that we privilege an able body and say that disabled bodies need to be pitied or fetishized. Our sense of having a good body, when we use that language, primarily has been restricted to what is the most desirable body as it's constructed by our social ideal. Is the body white? Is the body thin? Is the body able? Is the body fertile? Is the body useful? Is the body wealthy? Does it have access to privilege and space? So to deconstruct that and create this remembering of all bodies being good, just because they're alive, just because where life happens, it really starts to do something to the way that we understand our social fabric. And it's one thing for me to say, I want other people to have space in their bodies. I want other people to have access to social context and know that their bodies are free to be them. Fat bodies, queer bodies, right? All of that. But it's important to see that I am connected to that fabric. And if I am disconnected from my body, if I'm trying to make my body as a woman go away, if I'm going to have anorexia and make my body disappear just to feel like my body's ideal, then I'm perpetuating the same rhetoric of harm that is actually then used against other people in their bodies. So to flip it on its head and to say, I want to know that my body is good, is to come back into what I would call embodiment, the sense of being a body, not just a mind that carries around a body, or what we call like the brain is this carried around by the meat suit, the body taxi, right? This flesh that's actually like, when we look at our faith traditions, sometimes we hear things like the flesh is bad, the spirit's good, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. is to say, no, actually, maybe the body is where life happens. And the body is actually where joy and vitality and connection and pleasure happens. And maybe the body, regardless of what society says about appearance, maybe the body in its substance is goodness. Mm. And if that's the case, what does that do for how I show up in space, how I feed myself, how I nourish, how I advocate for other people's bodies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That's powerful. And I think, you know, we talk so much about language and how powerful language is and a body that is good, right? Just starting from that point of that frame of reference, that point of view is so powerful. Oh. And you're right. I mean, if you think about the commercials that you watch, you know, all the things that you're inundated with on social media, it's all about these certain images. And so kind of, I think the deeper that we're going into some of this in terms of like the digital, you know, era and being inundated constantly and really, you know, it's really starting to mold us in a way, right? If we're not and transform us in it, whether we, you know, good or bad, if we're not aware of it and we're not purposeful about it, it can have, you know, extreme consequences, as you know, and I'm sure that it's a lot of what you discuss with your patients. You know, one of the things that you talk about is courage. And I'm sure, like, you know, going at some of these things takes a lot of courage, and the fact that you are giving people encouragement, right, by, you know, helping them have courage. You had a quote, the courage starts by showing up and letting ourselves be seen. That's by Brené Brown, that you have a quote on your website. Tell us about courage, and how do you give people that? How do you instill that into them? Can you do that? And what does that look like?
Right. Yeah. Courage. One of the things that I love most about courage is that it doesn't have to be without fear. In fact, the way that we define courage is that it shows up in the presence of fear. Instead of it being a feeling, it's actually a descriptor. And that's really important to distinguish, because sometimes we'll say to people like, wow, you're so courageous. And they're like, I don't feel courageous. We're like, yeah, that's probably proof that you are courageous, because what do you feel in this moment? You probably feel terrified and like scared out of your mind. So the fact that you are showing up, that you are engaging, that you are risking in the face of that fear tells us that there is actually this other thing that's going on here. And we could call it courage. We could call it spirit, transformance, hope, whatever we want to call it. But there is something in you that is saying, even though the fear is here, I'm going to do this anyway, because I believe that there is something in this for me that will take me towards my growth, my healing, my transformation, my connection, by flourishing. Mm-hmm. So can we give people courage? I'm not necessarily so sure about that, but what we can do is we can make it safer for people to take risks. We can say, when you have fear and you are moving towards that thing that really matters for you, I'm not going anywhere. And in that way, we accompany them so that the fear, especially if the fear is about rejection or aloneness or failure, then some part of their nervous system knows the fear is manageable. There's this really fascinating research about, it's not about courage so much as it is about curiosity, but it feels like a cousin in what we're talking about here. And the research says that if people are alone and don't have access to an attachment figure, so that language that we use in the field of psychology is like someone who's attuned, connected, stable, sturdy, they're loving us, they know how to repair if we like miss each other. So if we are doing something that feels risky or new, and we don't have an attachment figure with us, or we have someone who's actually kind of like judgmental towards us, we're much more likely to be flooded with fear, and a fear in a way that would immobilize us or stop us. But if we have the presence of someone who is an attachment figure for us, or is creating a sense of attunement, connection, safety, honoring, like even that word that you use, DJ, encouragement of us, then what seems to be possible is that in terms of how our brain perceives the novel situation, the new uncertainty, it seems that our nervous system spontaneously has access to curiosity and a sense of adventure instead of being inhibited or overwhelmed by fear. But the caveat is the situation hasn't changed. It's that there's the presence of another person who is like, I believe in you and I am not going anywhere. You know what? Whatever is around the corner, we're going to face that together. That allows our body to not be inhibited, but allows us to access the sense of, well, okay, what is around the corner? What's it going to be like? I can't wait to find out. I'm scared, but I'm still ready to move forward.
Wow, that's really good. You know, one of the questions that I really wanted to ask you after listening to, you know, your podcast and a number of episodes, those who haven't listened, check it out, right? Other People's Problems. It's cool because for somebody as and myself who's never been in therapy, you get a little sneak peek or a look behind the curtain on what is that like, that interaction. And it makes it more real. It makes me feel like, oh, okay, this is not like what you see in a movie or a television show or whatever, right? This is, you know, and there might be some parallels, but ultimately, like it's the conversation lands a little different as like a fly on the wall. When do you know that therapy can be for you? You know what I mean? I don't know that I suffer from anxiety per se, but I feel like I suffer from anxiety. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm not like, I would never know how to self-diagnose myself as somebody who like needs to, like wants to get help in that area, right? Because sometimes my anxiety or what I feel is that I'm using that as a vocabulary word. Also oftentimes seems like an engine for me. It actually is something that allows me to be productive. But at the same time, I feel like in other areas of my life, it holds me back. And so like, when do I know how to go there and how to explore that further, you know?
Oh, I love your question. It's so good. It's so important. So I'm going to speak from my discipline and my training. My doctoral work is in the area of counseling psychology, which is just slightly adjacent to clinical psychology. Counseling psychology, although we have like we're trained in diagnosis and treatment in the same way, it's actually like our theoretical framework that's a bit different. And counseling psychology says there's actually more to the person than symptom reduction. There is potential for flourishing. And justice and our social fabric is deeply woven into our mental well-being. And those things need to be acknowledged, that we're not just an individual, we are part of a collective. So I am more disposed to say to a person, like, would you like to grow? Was there somewhere that you would like to grow? Would you like a place where you can be seen in what's happening, where you can be heard, where you can learn to hear your own voice, where you could tweak, okay, how is that drive helping me? And what are the areas where it's not helping me? And what could I do differently? Like, I think that therapy is not necessarily this agenda where I'm going to talk about 8 things and we're going to do 8 sessions. It's a relationship. Mm-hmm. And in any good relationship, if you are heard, then you get to decide what you want out of it. Whereas in maybe some other clinicians would say, well, like if you don't meet diagnostic criteria for a depressive disorder or an anxiety disorder, like you're probably fine. And so my interest is in seeing a repair of our collective, a repair of the way that we are in community with each other. Because I think, and other people have spoken and written extensively about this, it's not my particular area of expertise, but this idea that we have cultural trauma, that there are things like in Canada, I know the political context is just a little bit different, but we have like we're still grappling with the ongoing and historic abuses of Indigenous people and our residential school system and the way that colonization has deeply impacted and fractured our relationship with the land. What does it mean when everything that we buy and eat comes in plastic? What does it mean when the people who knew how to be in right relationship with the earth were murdered by our government, right? And then we look at the social fabric in the States, the legacy of abuses of Indigenous people and the legacy of slavery and racism and the ongoing racism that exists. We have a social fabric that needs to be healed. And when we have a social fabric that has trauma written into it, that's going to shape the way that parents show up. That's going to shape the way that we understand emotions. That's going to shape the way that we understand our bodies. That's going to shape our school system. And so if we're looking at an individual and saying like, oh, like I feel okay. That could sometimes be because we're okay. And sometimes be because we have gotten so used to a dysfunctional normal. And therapy gets to be, I've used this word already, a corrective experience where we're like, whoa, maybe there's some stuff that I got used to growing up that was just my parents' way of coping with their pain because they learned that from their parents' way of coping with their pain. And I can break some sort of cycle in this pattern of like why we never talk about hard things at the dinner table or how come it is that like every time dad talks about Vietnam, he shuts down and starts drinking excessively or whatever the thing is, like, can I be a link in the chain So even if I don't feel like things are off, maybe there's a way that when I show up and I self-reflect and I understand my family patterns and I try to do something different, I'm not only liberating me, but the future generations and what I bring when I go back into my family context and my culture as a person who is attuned, who listens well, who's sensitive to the pain of others. So I think therapy is a tool for social change and social action. Again, we have to do better in my field at making therapy accessible. So it's not just like, okay, great, the wealthy get to do social change, but like everybody gets to say, hey, there's space for my pain. But I love to say to people, if you're interested in knowing what it's about and you've never tried, you can always go once or twice and then not again. Like, it's not like this thing you have to sign up. You just sign up and spend your life savings. And
Well, and I think that, you know, for maybe for the kind of the regular person, it's kind of even just that first, like even understanding where should I be exploring these questions? Like, you don't just like jump on a yellow book and be like, or white pages or whatever and be like, okay, oh yeah, this is, this is I'm going to call Hillary. Right. So, you know, there's kind of this exploration, and part of the exploration, at least for somebody like myself, who's 37 years old, you know, I've noticed over the last few years, handful of years, decade changes, you know, where if you'd ask me to just, hey, describe how you're feeling or what you're like today, 10 years ago, I think I would have had a certain set of, you know, kind of notes about myself that are completely different now. And I've become more aware of like those changes as they're happening. In some cases, I'm like watching myself and be like, huh, like that's different than I would have responded to something in the past, good or bad. And it's interesting because navigating some of those things and what it all means. So that's why I'm asking those questions, because like I have interest myself in exploring, you know, therapy in a way that, you know, is not because I have, you know, I see myself having problems that I need to solve for, but that I want to kind of understand, you know, some of my journey, you know? Like knowing when and where that's, you know, it's like, and where that is. My other follow-up, you know, is around empathy, because, you know, 2020 has been crazy, right? You know, obviously in the States, and I don't know how, I don't know what your perspective is up in DC, but it's been crazy for all of us, the pandemic. And then, you know, where we are in the States and all the things happening from a social, you talk about, you know, social injustice and all these social changes. You know, and I imagine that empathy is something that it comes across your desk, if you will, often with your clients and patients. But and then from a social perspective, how do those two things relate? And what is the power in empathy as you see it?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, empathy is, it's the medicine. So empathy, just to back up a little bit, it's, we can do it in a couple ways. There can be a kind of like rudimentary empathy where we do some perspective taking. We're like, oh, I can imagine if I felt that, you know, if I was going through what you're going through, we're kind of like doing the math to, you know, do the algebra in our head. Oh, then I probably feel this way. Oh, that would suck for you, sort of thing. And it kind of like, we're doing a little bit of perspective taking. There's some emotion in it. But empathy, when it's at its finest, is us actually feeling in our bodies, feeling in a felt way what's happening for the other person. We are holding their pain. We're actually feeling their pain. And that's not something that is construed. It's not something that is like psychedelically oriented. It's our brain's natural way of being in community with each other. In fact, there's a whole section of neurons in our brain called mirror neurons, which allow us, it's the same thing that's responsible for us yawning when someone else yawns. So if you've ever had that happen, that's the same thing that helps you do empathy. It's like, oh, you're doing something and feeling something. Oh, I can feel it in my body. Or if you've ever watched a movie and somebody's in pain and you're like, oh, you don't even catch it, but you're grimacing and you're like bracing. Oh, they're getting, you know, the villain's torturing the hero of the story. Oh, I can feel it in my body. Like that's empathy. And empathy is meant to help us respond to other people. It's meant to help us go, oh, if you're in joy, oh, I want to be in joy. You got some good news. I want to get some, right? And we do this like thing where we amplify the emotion and we connect with someone and celebrate, or vice versa. If someone's in pain, we're actually wired to feel that in our body so that we go over and we comfort them. Mm-hmm. When we create these divisions between groups of people or identity or communities, it it starts to pull apart that natural thing that our brain body wants to do. And I don't think that our screens help us, because we learn to see people as objects or kind of these like two-dimensional characters instead of the living, breathing, the texture on someone's face, the quality of their voice, all of that. So empathy is really meant to help another person alleviate their pain and amplify their joy. It's what motivates us to then say, oh, wait a second, there's a thing at play here that keeps hurting you. And because I care so much about you and it hurts me that you're hurting, I'm going to do something about that with you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it can empower us to affect social change. But the irony, and this is where, like, to come back to your question, Harry, where therapy is really interesting, is that empathy is something that we can shut down doing. It's our body's natural thing, but we can shut it down when it hasn't happened to us and we've been told don't feel. So if we can't have access to our feelings, how can I feel in me what you're feeling in you? If I've learned to say, shove it down, don't go there, it actually inhibits our ability to tune into that in other people. But we can get that back when someone tunes into our feelings and teaches us to feel and shows us, this is like often what we call a right brain to right brain process. This is the attunement, micro attunement of a caring, skilled, safe, regulated other, is that it retrains our brain to feel our stuff and retrains our brain to be able to feel other people's stuff in a way that isn't overwhelming to us.
Hmm. Very interesting. Really interesting. Cause I think of the application for leaders, for mm-hmm. parents. And I have so many follow-up questions. So I'm going to try to narrow down. The first one's going to be a really simple yes or no.
Okay.
Is it possible to be a great leader and not have empathy?
No.
Okay. The next question, how do I get better in the area? If I'm a leader and I struggle with empathy, how do I get better in that area?
It's probably going to be hard to work it out on the job. It's probably going to be a little funky, a little messy. So finding someone who you're not responsible for in a power dynamic and practicing it there first is important. Practice with your friends.
Okay.
Practice in therapy.
The last part of the question is more like, I think a lot of parents struggle with this, especially if they came from families like Harry and I, where, you know, like excellence was demanded, you know, pick yourself up, don't cry, right? All the things. And so like, I see this I have five children, ages 2 to 12. Okay. And with my son, you know, I, you know, knowing that I had a father that you were never allowed to cry and show emotion.
Right.
Right? And like, I'm more of the type where I do show emotion, you know, I am the, I love you type. But I also realized too, that I want to raise a son that is reacting appropriately. So he will cry over certain things. And I'm like, why are you crying? Like, you know, so how do I balance being empathetic and letting him show emotion versus being somebody that's saying, okay, that's something that is silly and it may not meet that level of reaction that he's giving.
Right. And how old is this son that you're talking
about? He's 7 years old.
Yeah. So he's right in the age where it's pretty developmentally appropriate for him to be having big feelings and learning how to work them out on his own.
Mm-hmm.
For parents, the complexity is when kids have emotions, instead of attributing that, you know, emotion as being valid or not, saying, okay, what are you feeling? Like, what is this sadness? Is this fear? Is this anger? Are you disappointed? Mm-hmm. Great. So let's use this opportunity to figure out, okay, it might be about the spilled milk right now or the truck or the thing that happened at work, but you're going to feel sad so many times in your life. Let's talk about what you do when you feel sad so that when this feeling comes up in the future, you know how to be with it, you know how to move through it, and you know how to find a way forward.
Gotcha.
So instead of actually seeing like the kids in this developmental stage, they need to learn the skills, not just about, you know, the judgment of what's appropriate to react to, but how do I be with feelings?
Mm-hmm.
And the irony is that so many people are really good at the other of the side of it where they're like shove down the hard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do that without shoving down the good stuff. And so then people who are really good at being like, well, I'm going to repress my sadness or my fear about something are also, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, like, how come I feel dead inside? How come I can't feel joy? And like, why do I have heart disease? Like, we have all the research to show that when we are repressing emotion, it's more likely to cause disease. It's more likely to cause autoimmune disease, heart issues, right? Degeneration of certain parts of our tissue. So if we are sacrificing that, right? The cost is too high. So I always like to say to parents, like, do your work around noticing, like, what is your reaction about that? Mm-hmm. Think about this as an appropriate time to say, okay, let's learn to be with that feeling in a regulated way. And emotion regulation, we can actually see, I mean, especially because you were saying, DJ, excellence has been an important part of your family values.
Yeah. Yeah.
We know that emotion regulation is a more significant predictor of academic success over IQ. So kids who are more emotionally regulated are more likely to fare better and perform better in school, even when we control in the statistical analysis for socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
And emotion regulation is not just, I know how to stop big feelings from taking over, but it's also, I know how to be with what I'm feeling appropriately. And I know how to feel motivation and joy and connection.
Yeah.
So the ability to go, how much am I feeling? How do I deal with it? Is this an appropriate amount given the context?
Mm-hmm.
Where am I going to go if I'm having this big reaction and I'm at school, and that's not actually okay. Can I actually make room for it at home though? When I do go home, can I be really sad and make room for it there?
No, that's great. And that's super helpful. And I actually, after listening to your podcast, I should have known I need to listen a little bit more, not provide as much. Right. and I would have been straight. I should have been listening to your podcast a long time ago. No, it's really good. And, you know, Harry and I, and we're going to have a couple kind of quick fire questions, but just to kind of wrap this up, when we were researching you and talking about you, I know you refer to yourself as a counselor, but actually we would refer to you as a coach. And it's interesting because when you tell somebody that they need some coaching, you know, or we're going to give you some coaching, that's deemed as, oh yeah, I want to grow. I want to get better. I want to work as, you know, whereas a counselor, it's like, hey, I'm not sitting behind some desk and having somebody take me back to, you know, how it was as a kid or whatever it is. And, and so I think that, you know, what's interesting about what you were saying about social, you said social flourishing, you know, being able to flourish and get better. And like Harry said, you don't have to be sick to get better, as opposed to trying to fix everything. We're already told how broken we are all the time.
Oh yeah.
Right. And so, you know, I think that's why people are reluctant to go to a counselor, because they're like, you know, I don't want to hear why I'm bad, you know, and that's not obviously the value that you bring. You help people, you know, maximize their strengths and help them, you know, talk about where there are weaknesses, why that is. And I love the work that you're doing. So thanks for sharing the knowledge on the podcast today. So Harry, I'm gonna let you go ahead and take away. I know we got some fun questions.
These have all been fun. I'm not gonna lie. This is like you walked right into my turf.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, so just a little rapid fire, get to know Hillary.
Ooh.
You know, thoughts, just a handful.
Okay.
For those of us who haven't been to Vancouver, BC, but do plan to go. Where's your favorite place to eat?
Oh my gosh. Oh, there's so many. I love this place called Jam Jar, which is a Lebanese kitchen. It's right around the corner from me. There's Granville Island, which is it's kind of like the Seattle Pike Place Market, but a little less kitschy. Like locals actually shop there, that sort of thing. They've got just tons of great local vendors and food. And so often it's right by my office.
Yeah. As much as Seattle's like a second home, and I have not gotten to Vancouver, and it's kind of sad. So what is your favorite holiday tradition?
Oh,
holiday as in this season that we're in now.
Sure. Okay. So, I love doing all the like decorating and the stuff and the music. My mom plays this like really horrendous Celine Dion Christmas CD, and we joke and we mock her. And there's just like all of this love around that. But I think one of my favorite things ever is we as a family open stockings on Christmas morning. And I have the emotional energy on Christmas of like a 5-year-old. It's for me, like so I good. Look like an adult, but I'm not, yeah. I'm just like, get me the presents. I want the things. We open the stockings and we all put our stockings on our feet. Like we're wearing them like socks, and we just wear them on our feet for the rest of the day. And it's absurd and hilarious, and we slip and fall. And I just
so good.
Love it. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay. Who's someone that inspires you?
Oh my gosh. Oh, so many people. What comes to mind right now? I'm thinking about Dr. Joy Cox. Interviewed her on another one of the podcasts that I'm on. Thinking about Chloe Valdery and her work. Robin Henderson Espinoza, a theologian ethicist, a trans friend of mine who's doing really important work around Yeah. Like awesome. Faith spaces. I mean, just, I have so many, so many people in my life.
Good. Yeah. Okay. We talked about fear a little bit on this podcast.
Yep.
What's something that you're afraid of?
Oh, just one thing. Oh my gosh.
It could be more than one.
Spiders.
That's my wife. My wife is just like,
I'm snakes.
You that's are?
Yeah. I can't, yeah. I don't care if it's a little garden snake or whatever. Really? I don't care if it's small, but I fear of like stuff coming out of the toilet.
Good. My brother growing up had a bunch of snakes and like a terrarium in his room, and they would get out sometimes. And like, so I think I was just, But I was conditioned to be like, oh, I can have them crawl on me.
Do you guys know what the number one fear is? Do you guys know?
Is it public speaking?
It is. It's public speaking. Yeah. I think spiders is second. It's a close second. But what's funny is that you're a speaker, you know, and we all speak and we all do public speaking, but a spider or a snake or, you know, it's like, no, don't
get that near me.
That's funny. Okay. So the last one is about you. Where can people, this is more or less of a rapid and more of a wrap up. Where can people find you? You know, are you on social? What's coming up next? Is there any projects or anything like that you're doing? You know, you got your podcasts and books and different things. What's happening as we turn the page in 2021?
Yes. So you've mentioned my podcast, Other People's Problems. We're working on season 4 right now, which is great. And then I'm the host on another podcast as well called The Liturgists. So that's, you can find that. We do all sorts of cool stuff there on the intersection of faith, science, and art. And then I got a couple of books out. One is a textbook, so nobody reads that except for my university students.
Yeah.
So I won't even mention the title of that. But there's Mothers, Daughters, and Body Image, which is all about bodies and the stories that we pass between each other about bodies. And then I've got a new book coming out. It'll be end of 2021 called The Wisdom of the Body. And this is all about everything from pain and emotion, body image, trauma, power and oppression in the body, spirituality in the body. So a lot of the stuff we dug into today. You can find me on Instagram, Hillary Liana McBride, and on Twitter, Hillary L. McBride, and my website's hillarylmcbride.com.
Awesome. Well, good. Well, listen, we really appreciate having you. It's really fun, interesting. In fact, I feel like there's so much that we didn't get a chance to cover that we're going to have you on for a second opportunity.
I feel so much smarter, Harry. I feel so much smarter right now. You know,
that's not difficult for you. you can bring on. No, I'm just kidding.
See, you know what, Hillary? I'm going to need. I need a session now. See, because he's bringing me down.
Some couples work here for you.
Yeah, some more empathy. Sorry. But yeah, we really enjoyed talking to you and look forward to continuing to follow you. And
thank you.
You know, like I said, hopefully you'll visit us again.
That's right. Awesome. That's right. What an honor. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Hillary.
It's such a joy to chat with you two today.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Be well.
You've been listening to the Room Tilters podcast. If you love it, do us a favor and rate us. Write us a review and share it with a friend. We appreciate you, our listeners. And remember, you don't have to be sick to get better.